Hi, I'm Misha Ketchell, editor of The Conversation. For democracy to work, people need to be well informed. That's why we work with academic experts to share their research and explain issues in the news. Everything we do is free to republish, but we need your support. Please donate to The Conversation by going to donate.theconversation.com or following the link in the show notes.
Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is The Conversation's Politics Podcast. This week's budget presents some challenges for the Labor opposition because it's got many more sweeteners than we saw last year, which was all full of nasties. The opposition's reaction has been negative, predictably, but it's also accepting some of the measures, in particular the small business package, while noting and emphasising that a lot of the negatives from last year remain despite some government retreats. Today we talk with opposition finance spokesman Tony Burke about the government strategy, the opposition's reaction, and also Labor's coming national conference. Tony Burke, this budget is harder for the opposition to attack, isn't it, than the last one?
Well, one of the things when you only read the budget papers is all that appears in the budget papers are the new measures. So issues that are effectively still part of the budget that were announced last year but haven't yet made it through the parliament are still on foot, are still completely relevant to the budget conversation and still have real impacts. But unless as an opposition we're making sure that people realise that, if they're only dealing with the documents coming through from the government, that wouldn't come to attention. So the issues that I'm talking about are things like the cuts to schools and hospitals of $80 billion, the higher education changes with $100,000 degrees, changes of the nature of the cuts to family payments, or the change in the retirement age going all the way up to age 70. Now, they're all extremely relevant issues in the community, and they remain part of the budget debate, but only if the opposition makes sure that continues to be made clear.
And to the extent that these various issues come before the parliament, you will be opposing them.
Oh, our position on those, they failed the fairness test completely. There's no appetite from us to shift on those at all.
Do you think that this is an early election budget?
I don't know. To try to work out that, you're effectively engaging in trying to psychoanalyse the issues around one person, because it's ultimately of... There are many collective decisions in government, but the timing of an election is entirely the whim of a prime minister. So, yeah, compared to last year, where their full agenda and everything that they wanted to do was exposed for the first time, I can see why some people are saying, oh, well, maybe this one will be more popular than the last. But it's still in terms of what the government says that they stand for, an odd set of issues for them to think formed a really well-established platform. I mean, they've defined themselves on issues like doing something about the deficit. To have a situation where they've doubled it in 1 year on their own figures is hardly the sort of messaging you'd expect they'd want to go to the people on.
It's pretty important, though, for Labor, isn't it, to get their head around Tony Abbott's head on this election question, because you need to be prepared for an early election while obviously planning for the election to be at the normal time. Are you prepared?
Well, I think we've been better prepared than any opposition in living memory. The normal, and you'd know this better than most people in the gallery, the normal rhythm of an electoral cycle is that opposition start announcing things they'd spend money on, and as you get closer to the election, the government starts to say, but where's the money coming from? There's a big push about when the tax policy will be released, and it's usually not until quite late in the campaign that revenue items from an opposition start to come up. What we've done so far this term, and it's only the beginning of it, but is quite different to what previous oppositions have done, where we've looked at a 10-year budgetary cycle, we've looked at longer than the forwards demand, and we've been putting forward revenue items which make a big difference to the bottom line, and done that first rather than announcing a grab bag of expenditure items and trying to work out how to pay for it later. That's a big shift in how an opposition behaves, and the way that I think is the right way for an opposition to work in two principles. One, fiscally, it's just far more sensible that you're you're working out what you can raise before you start on any sort of wish list of where you'd want to put it. But secondly, I do believe there's an appetite for a more sensible conversation with the Australian people than might have happened in previous election campaigns. And I think gone are the days where you can say, well, here's what we'll spend, and then we'll just tell you about the bad bits after you've voted for us. The reaction to that budget last year was so volatile that there is an expectation on us to be putting those sorts of measures forward.
I can see the fiscal logic of that, but from the point of view of Mr. and Mrs. Parramatta, don't you need to get out the positive policies that a Labor government would undertake? They want to know what you do for their kids, what you do for their retiring parents, that sort of thing.
We had an unusual situation at the last budget, which I think was quite different to anything we saw during the Howard years. Howard policies, often either by design or just by the way they played out, you would often talk about Labor being wedged about an issue that would divide either Labor parliamentarians or at least Labor constituencies. What this government did in that last budget was effectively draw the partisan line right in front of what we regard as our strongest ground. So they made the political debate and the message to the community about where are the priorities in terms of helping families with family payments? Where are the priorities in terms of making sure that pensioners have a decent living and a decent standard of living through the years to come? Even though they had gone to the election claiming that there was a bipartisan approach to Gonski education funding, straight away made it clear that the funding out beyond the forwards was something they were not committed to at all.
And you made it clear what you were against, but that's rather different from positive policies.
Well, I don't know that those can only be seen through the frame of what we are against. For example, the education reforms had only been introduced a year or two earlier, had been part of a very long process, and have an implementation period that goes way into the next decade. So to simply say, yes, the frame that you put it in is not, I don't entirely reject it, in that the government tried to do something and we were standing opposed to it. But what the government was trying to do was to take away things that have been the fundamental positive direction, both for productivity and for fairness, that Labor's been advocating.
Just a detail on if there was an early election. In your state of New South Wales, there's a redistribution, so this affects candidate selection more than normally. How would all that work?
Well, before you get to what the party has to do, there's something that the Electoral Commission would have to do. They haven't completed the redistribution yet. And it's not a normal redistribution. It's one where New South Wales has fewer seats. So what they do is they take the two seats that are adjacent with the lowest enrolment and combine them into one. So the first thing that would happen if that scenario were to follow would be a seat gets abolished straight away and you end up with one seat that is massive. Now, you then have to go through your pre-selection process with very quickly. But the last time we had to deal with this, as I recall, would have been during the Hawke years for the double dissolution. There was a very quick endorsement of sitting members that hadn't yet been pre-selected, and the processes were dealt with quickly. It's something that if you have to deal with it quickly, you do. If you're able to deal with things in a slower, more consultative manner, that's better.
Now, Labor has said this budget is unfair, but it's demonstrably fairer than the last one. Is there a danger people will think, well, you're just reprising the former line, your old line?
Well, a whole lot of the unfairness measures are still there. Because they were announced a year ago, they don't get printed, but they're still fundamental to all the numbers in this budget. So putting tertiary education out of reach to the extent where young people have to make a decision as to whether or not they want to have a degree or whether or not they're going to end up owning their own home is a decision that the government hasn't backed away from one millimetre. The changes to family payments, it's all still there. In terms of their new measures, some of the detail on those we still have to work through. There's some things they've put forward that we've already indicated we're supportive of.
We'll like check the jobs package, the small business package.
That's right.
So, and most of the jobs measures, presumably.
Yeah, and so for these, you don't give your final tick until you've actually seen the legislation, but the direction that we're taking on those is that we're supportive. A good part of particularly the small business measures are previous measures that Labor had in place that the government abolished 12 months ago. We protested. They said it had to go. 12 months later, they're saying they're bringing it back. They want to claim it's their idea. You know, well, at one level, who cares? It's part of the political argy-bargy, but it's not something that you'd have an incentive to vote against.
Do you think that most of the new budget measures, not the ones you were talking about before, will in fact get through the Senate?
I don't know. We have firmed our position, as we've seen more detail, in opposition to what the government's proposing for the savings in paid parental leave. The situation there that the government's wanting to change is bad for both employers and employees. For employers, if they've made a decision to put extra money on the table to try to attract employees, they've done it in the context that was already a government scheme in place and what they were paying for was additional. If the government scheme's taken away, employers will stop providing it. Now, if employers stop providing it, the government doesn't get the saving anyway. So you end up with no fiscal benefit and a big hit to both employers who are trying to do the right thing and employees who in negotiations had foregone other things like wage increases to get a benefit that's then taken from under them.
So they'll have to go to the crossbench on that. And how do you think they'll go?
I don't know. I've always had a rule in this place. I had a very brief time in an upper house in a state parliament, and I learnt very quickly it is never helpful for any member of the lower house to predict what's going to happen in an upper house. So I don't know how it'll go through the Senate, and the counting can be done by others. The merits of the policy, in my view, don't stack up either in terms of the social impact of the policy or the fiscal impact, given the behavioural change we'll get from employers.
Now, you were talking before about getting out revenue measures ahead of policy spending measures as in opposition. And as finance spokesman, you're central to that whole costing process. Are you going to put everything through the Parliamentary Budget Office? Will that be your way of costing things?
That's what we've been doing so far.
That'll continue?
Yeah, we're continuing with that. The thing when we talk about revenue items as well, and I think this is an exercise that we've engaged with that the government never really did and does matter, is that you first define what on earth the problem is that you're trying to deal with. And the problem is not one of an immediate emergency. That's what caused them to make some very bad economic decisions last year. The challenge is you need to make sure that structurally you deal with the structural deficit over the medium term so that whenever the next big international shock comes, hopefully it's not soon, but you know, whether it's global recessions or whatever it is, another big global shock will come at some point. You need to make sure that government is strong enough in its fiscal situation to be able to deal with that, as we did during the global financial crisis. Now, we had two tools back then. We had both the Reserve Bank with what it did in lowering interest rates, and we had the fiscal stimulus. At the moment, Reserve Bank has gone right down and doesn't have much room left to move if they wanted to help stimulate the economy. And from government's perspective, as long as we're in a structural deficit, the government's a bit constrained on what it can do there as well. So that's the problem, but that's also why you can have spending measures that raise the revenue and turn around the trajectory over a period of time that are much more effective than trying to have a massive impact right now, which effectively just whacks a hole in the middle of confidence for both consumers and business.
Now, I want to ask you finally about Labor's National Conference, which is bearing down on the party. It will be held in July, and there are at least three controversial issues. One is whether there should be a binding vote on MPs for gay marriage. Another is whether Labor should recognise a Palestinian state. And thirdly, whether it should accept that it would turn back votes in government. I wonder where you stand on these three issues. Firstly, the gay marriage binding vote.
Okay, well, on all of these, most of the debate and discussion and formal positions will be put much closer to the conference. So certainly I support the conscience vote. My view on conscience votes generally is both the parliament and the party are better by having more of them not fewer. And when the Labor Party had the reverse position to what it currently has on marriage equality, we did not provide a conscience vote for people with the reverse view, and I believe we should have. I've been consistent in my view on this the whole way through.
And you voted against?
My electorate, I didn't speak in the debate, I didn't get involved in the debate. I voted against last time. There was a big push that we would vote based on our electorates and what our electorates felt. I have on this particular issue arguably the most socially conservative electorate in Australia. I was respectful of their views when this vote came around. We'll look at particular proposals.
You do that again?
We'll look at...
If there was a conscience vote?
At the moment, we don't have a bill. We don't have a resolution before us. So I'm not going further on that. On the Palestinian issue, I will be moving a resolution. And so what's moved, I'll be voting for. I can guarantee that.
And that is just to recognise...
Well, it's to be based on the resolution that went through the New South Wales conference. Now, it had a number of conditions which, if not met, then Australia would consult with like-minded nations about recognition. So exactly
that
how
was
strong...
the Bodcar motion.
Yes. So exactly how strong that wording ends up at the national conference is something where there's some consultation going on. But realistically, the consultation right now is limited. There'll be a lot more of it as we get closer to the conference.
And on the boats?
On this, I'll let Richard Marles. I'll let Richard Marles be the person who speaks on that. Obviously, at the conference, I've been engaged in this debate at the conference very directly. The last two or three of them, my view and the prism through which I view this was always affected very strongly by a speech that Robert Ray actually made at a conference some years ago. Where he said we cannot limit our compassion to whoever is in the line of sight. And I'm always very much aware that any policies in this area need to be genuinely compassionate to who's in front of you, but also need to be compassionate towards the people who you may never see because they drown on the way here.
Tony Burke, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Good to talk again.
That's all from today. That's all from the Politics Podcast. Thanks to my producer, Matt Dawson. We'll be with you soon with another interview.
I was saved by God to make America great again.
An autocrat loves a crisis. A crisis is the way that they mobilize their base.
While America is under invasion from within, we're under invasion from within.
He's testing the boundaries of what he can get away with.
We should use some of these dangerous cities as training grounds for our military, National Guard, but military.
We've asked six of the world's preeminent scholars how we can measure the make of an autocrat. It's a recipe of sorts, tried and tested by the most infamous leaders in history.
Hugo Chavez in Venezuela.
Vladimir Putin in Russia.
Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler.
Viktor Orban in Hungary.
He's basically bulletproof in terms of criminal prosecution.
Join us from December 29 as we explore Trump, the making of an autocrat, from The Conversation.